Super excited to share this podcast with Stephen Webster, talking all things jewellery and his incredible career and all the stories that go with it.
I mean, I've known you for I don't know how many years, and I thought I pretty much knew everything about you, but everything I read, I didn't know. It's kind of like really weird. I mean, I sort of knew where you were born. I've met your dad. I didn't realise, you know, some of the things that you said about your dad, which we'll talk about, but I had no idea some of the stuff. So for everyone that's listening, you are one of the most amazing traditional craftsmen. And I say craftsman because you really, you don't just make jewelry and make a piece look beautiful. For me, your jewelry is like a piece of art. It has a story. And it's almost like when you look at a ring or a pendant or a pair of earrings, it's almost like you've dissected the idea to create it, to sort of give the experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I would describe myself as a craftsman, you know, because I think these days, everybody who's in the jewelry business is a jewelry designer. And I think when I entered the jewelry business 45 years ago, of course there were designers, but they were few and far between. You know, people in the industry were really the craftspeople. Yeah. You know, and that's where I learned by, you know, I did go to art school, but there it was still a bit like a technical college. Right. And so, you know, it was all about learning craft skills, and then I did an apprenticeship. So my way in was from the materials. So I think very much like what you do, you kind of get a sense for the material, what a material does, how it works, you know, and so that's how I started to design, was from being a technician, if you like. I could much easier realize something in the material than at the time sitting there and drawing something that was not using that material.
But I mean, it was interesting because it said that you then went and did an apprenticeship in Hatton Gardens, which everyone knows is like the diamond street, isn't it? Where all the diamond dealers are. But you then met somebody. Tell us about the gemologist that you met, because your work is very much to do with stone and colour and form. So tell us about that.
Well, I did my apprenticeship, and you're quite right, in the sort of the hub of London's jewellery district. And it started off very traditionally. I was working for a handmade chain maker, which, to be honest, even the thought of handmade chains in London now is extraordinary. But you know, this was a 150-year-old company, and the designs we were working to were sort of, I suppose, based on like Victorian designs, you know, fob chains and all this. They do, but they're not making chains anymore, sadly. But you know, so I started doing that, and then I think because I'd had experience at art school, I thought, well, this is not quite the kind of creative industry that I thought I was going to enter, because art school, you do a bit of everything, you know, to do with jewelry. And I was sort of very much making chains. And, you know, the thing about a chain is you finish and you kind of start again. It just never ends. It's just one long chain.
Yeah.
And I sort of ventured out a bit and sort of discovered, if you like, a different side of jewelry, which was a more of a design driven. And the people who were in the design side of jewelry at the time, a lot of them were sort of rooted in the 60s. I mean, the most famous one was Andrew Greimer. And I think Andrew Greimer and his group, one of whom I went and worked for to finish my apprenticeship, is called John Donald. They sort of deformalized a lot of what jewelry had been up until that point, fine jewelry, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the things with gold, diamonds, rubies, etc. And I think they sort of were deconstructing it, and still it was still beautiful and beautifully made, but just without the formality. And so I was fortunate that I'd kind of caught the tail end of my training. I'd had that exposure, and by the time I finished, so sort of 5 years down the line, I was sort of ready for anything. And this guy had come to London who happened to be Canadian, and I thought he was American because he sounded American, but he was looking for someone who could be a bit sort of self-sufficient, if you like, in the industry, which I didn't really know what that fully involved. But being as I was 21, I was up for it, you know. So yeah. He flew me to Canada, and I woke up in the morning. I'd flown into Calgary at night. And I woke up in the morning in Banff, Alberta, and I thought I was sort of a victim of the slave trade or something, because I couldn't work. Well, first it was minus 27 degrees, so I couldn't really function properly in that. And then I'm like up a mountain. But the thing was, he had a shop, a store, and it was in Banff High Street. And Banff High Street, like a lot of ski resorts, you know, it had wealth every now and again when it was ski season. And his passion was rocks and gems. And he had no jewelry side, and so he did actually have one jeweler working for him, but he wasn't really trained the same as I had been. So he just needed someone who could be the goldsmith for this shop.
When you saw all the gems, though, was there kind of like an aha moment where you just sort of thought, oh my God, like, was that like where Crystal Haze and all of that, was that, do you think that's where it all started?
Well, it did, but my aha moment was a bit like, uh-oh, what am I going to do now? Because, you know, I think even though I'd worked for this designer jeweller in London, I had no way had exposure to the sort of gems he would spend his whole life just going to mining areas and come back with very exotic gems, which now might be more run-of-the-mill, but you would never have heard these words in 1981 in London, like tanzanite and savorite and all the colored tourmalines. And so you just sort of plonk them down and say, now it's your turn, you know? And so as horrific as that was at first, it's how I kind of cut my teeth and, you know, sort of that baptism by fire, you know? And at first it wasn't like I had a style. I just would make something that felt like it would work with whatever was put in front of me. But that did lead to me sort of some years later, led me into like Crystal Haze. And I think without that sort of exposure, there's no way I would have developed a Crystal Haze technique. It was because I'd been working with a more raw material for a start. I could play with it more. It wasn't like, you know, when you play with, you can't really play with a diamond. You can put diamonds in a piece of jewelry and play with the jewelry. Yeah. but you know, how it comes is how it comes. You know what I mean? You don't chip away at it. And so if I think I carve it that way, it tends to not be like that because it's all so precious. And at the time, these stones, they've become precious now, but then were far less so. And they were bigger and they felt like you could have more fun with them. And so that kind of was how I developed what I would say was more my style through just exposure to those rocks.
Because we met, and I remember, I can't remember the first time we met, but I remember meeting you in the is it Portland Swimming Bars? Yeah. There was like an event.
I met you there. That's where I met you.
Where we met, through a mutual friend.
We
weren't swimming, so I was sort of trying to sort of paint the picture. It had no water. And we started chatting, and I remember saying to you, because I think I must have seen one of your pieces of jewellery, and I remember saying, can we meet up? And you came over to my home, and it's where I bought my first, I think it was a Crystal Haze, wasn't it?
Yeah,
but it was a different shape. I haven't seen you do that again, but it was kind of slightly raised. And I just remember you opening up this, unfolding this thing, and there were those rings, and I went straight to this one that had mother of pearl in the base that made the whole thing light up, and it was just absolutely, I'd never seen anything like it, and I mean I still absolutely love it. But the Crystal Haze was a game changer, really. And one of the things that I read that I absolutely didn't know about you was that you went and lived in California. I don't know how I didn't know that.
Well,
And then, so tell everybody the story about Elizabeth Taylor, Michael Douglas, Goldie Hawn, all of that. Because for me, that must have been like a sort of tipping point. And how old were you then?
Well, so from Canada, I stuck it out as long as I could until it snowed on my birthday. And as you know, my birthday's in the middle of August. And so I thought, enough's enough. I've got to get out of this place. And so I actually moved back to London. But at the time, I think I probably felt as much of a fish out of water in London as I had done in Canada, because you kind of lose a bit of where you belong. And this guy, this Canadian guy called Mike, he, when I left, three of the people I'd been at art school with now worked for me in Canada, because I'd been rounding them up, you know. And
right.
So he, I left, and I suppose he just felt, you know what, I'm done here. So he sold the business and my friends, which they've never forgiven me for. But and he moved to California. He said, I'm moving to Santa Barbara. Would you come back and do it all again? And I thought, well, it's probably not going to snow on my birthday. So I ended up in Santa Barbara. And I think in Santa Barbara, by then I was 24 and or 24, 25. It was the mid 80s. My jewelry was probably bang on for the period, because...
But how many pieces would you have designed or had to show at that point?
Well, I kind of made them... Yeah, I didn't. I did things that we had in stock, because I had to fill the shop. But
right.
The shop was full of sort of individual pieces of jewelry, you know, because the stones, if there was a set of stones, I might be able to make a bracelet and a ring or a pair of earrings and a pendant. You know, it was very much determined that way. And so we had very interesting jewelry in the shop, very colourful. And you know, my favorite ring even then to make was a cocktail ring, because it just felt like that's a ring that you're meant to have fun with. And, you know, the ring you bought from me, I would class as a cocktail ring,
yeah.
The Crystal Haze. And I made one at the time. I'd made one that was, I designed it, made it. It was a lavender carbuncle, so cabochon, quite big.
Yeah.
And it was white gold, and it had a band running around the stone, the bezel of the stone, and the band was rose gold, and engraved in it was like thorns and roses. And I'd done it all myself. I'd engraved it, made it, set it. And so it was just one of the pieces that were in the shop. And then Elizabeth Taylor came by. I mean, we were in the Biltmore.
Literally walked into the shop?
Yeah, because we had one store in the Biltmore, in the Four Seasons, in Montecito, which is there's no bad end of Santa Barbara, but Montecito's like the really posh end. So
right.
So that's where the store was, and so they just said to me, oh, Elizabeth Taylor's just bought your ring. I was like, what? I mean, it seemed crazy.
But how did that feel though? Can you remember? Was it was it like surreal?
Yeah, but it was a bit surreal, because even though I was now living in California, I'd still not met a celebrity, and I think that one being, you know, she was an icon of jewelry and everything else. And
everything. But what I'm interested in is that, you know, one of the questions I ask people is, like, obviously today we have Instagram and it's very driven by who wears jewelry or fashion or lives in homes that are designed. And that moment, did you realize that the impact that would have, or was it just kind of like a feeling that you're okay, you know, you didn't need to prove anything? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I phoned my mum. I don't know if that counts, but
yeah,
only because I knew that she liked Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think she thought I was kidding anyway, but you know, no, of course there was no real way of telling anybody. It just happened, and then you it was exciting, and then she commissioned a bracelet and a pair of earrings to go with the ring. So, you know, you now have made stuff for a celebrity, and I think.
But that was a real celebrity.
Yeah,
I mean,
you know,
like when you talk to someone like Richard Young, who we both know, and he says the days of, you know, turning up at somewhere and just capturing that moment of a real true legend, whereas today it's also kind of pre-programmed. I mean,
yeah. No,
do you know
it's
what
true.
I mean?
I agree. And I mean, obviously, I've spoken to Richard a lot about these things. And funny enough, when I opened my own first store in LA, which was 10 years ago, so much, much later than that period, I had a place above the store that I called the No Regrets Lounge. And the idea of that was that I could sort of just share with my clients the things I enjoyed. So there was no jewelry up there. It was either a chef or a photographer. So the first exhibition I did was Richard's work, and it was all of his pictures of Elizabeth Taylor. And
was
the
she
reason,
wearing your ring?
No, it was that. No, she's mainly falling out of tramp or somewhere. But anyway, she was the first celebrity that he papped, really.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, I think legend has it, as he says, that she first of all kicked him out of the event. Then he got contacted the next day and asked if they could see the photographs. So and he had a relationship with her, you know, and so we that felt like the right thing to do, you know, when I opened a store in Beverly Hills. And I think with some of those other people, the Douglases, I mean, the Douglases were, they lived there, you know, they lived in Montecito. Michael Jackson lived there. They didn't all come in the store. I mean, Michael Jackson didn't, but the Douglases did, and Goldie Hawn, because Montecito was like a, you know, it's kind of got, they're all in the hills there. Oprah has a place up there, and she, you know, she became a client of mine later on. But so you if you had a store that was definitely the best jewelry store in the village, you're probably going to pick up a few of those people.
Except that you were different, though, because in a way, like, you know, they were amazing jewelers of that time, but you were very different, and what you were producing was different, so it caught the eye of people. So there must have been a moment then, because, like, did you realize at that point you would become successful, or was that just never in your thoughts?
Not really. I think if you think about it, I mean, I was, like I said, I was 24, 25 when I moved there. By the time I moved back to London, I was 29. And I had a Harley Davidson, I had a sports car. I just thought I had everything I needed in life, you know. I mean, it wasn't really about being successful. I was just really happy that my career, which had I stayed in England as being the sort of bench jeweler that I would have stayed, probably wouldn't have given me that. And it wasn't like I was wealthy. I was just that I was having a nice life, you know, and I was young. So I came back to London, and I think from that point, it was more of a struggle because I didn't have, I had no base of clients at all. So for about 5 years, I would design a small collection or group of jewelry and just fly back to Santa Barbara because I knew people there. I'd sell them and then come back again. And in some ways that commute became part of my life. And it wasn't really till I met Asia, which was about 95. So sort of 5 years after that, where she and some of my other American friends were a bit like, man, you got to get your name out there because you're like an amazing jeweler. No one knows who you are. So they were quite instrumental in me coming out from behind the scene and coming out the front. Once I did that, we did get some good success. I think I probably wasn't long from when I met you, because when I met you, I turned up on my motorbike.
I remember, but I mean, Asya is amazing. She's got the gift of the gab of, like, getting, you know, a name out there. She totally was behind you. And I remember you were constantly on a plane going to do these events where you would sell your jewelry. And I remember your beautiful tiny little store in London, which was off
Duke Street, Manchester Square.
Yeah, which I used to love going to because it was literally tiny. And you'd go in and Asya would bring out all these little bits and you'd end up leaving with a bag full of stuff. But in a funny sort of way, it was like what I loved about that, and I sort of miss in a way sometimes with brands, is that there was that kind of excitement of going in and discovering something. And because it wasn't such a large space, you felt like you had something that no one else had. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think it's because, you know, it wasn't put together in any way other than this sort of authentic, organic growth. You know, there was no, I mean, I'd love to tell you there was a plan, but there wasn't really a plan. I mean, it wasn't from nothing, because, like I say, I kind of had a livelihood that wasn't bad. And then I started to sort of fall right into this place where jewelry was about to be discovered. It was a bit like everything was very quiet and hushed. You had your Van Cleef and Cartier and Bulgari, but probably no one knew what any of those people looked like. You know, they were kind of behind the scenes.
And it
probably about 96 was when people wanted to know more about jewelry. And of course, if you're one of the people who's making, I suppose, jewelry of the day, because that's what it was. It was jewelry that women were, first of all, you're a perfect example, buying for themselves. buying according to their style. And that was like a jewelry revolution, because prior to that time, jewelry was pretty much bought by men for women.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
And that really allowed us in, if you like. So people like, you know, my contemporaries like Solange Azaguri Partridge, she had a tiny little store, as you know, myself, a bit later on, Sean Lean. But, you know, you started to see these kind of characters pop up, and business was probably pretty good because you were kind of what the market wanted. And it was actually very easy to get publicity. I remember the first time I was interviewed from the Daily Telegraph. It was crazy. It was like, wow, the Daily Telegraph, you know, and they came to the shop, did an interview, all the things you would expect nowadays. But that was brand new.
But don't you kind of miss that? Because in a sense, you know, you and I are born in the same year, but today you put something on Instagram and that's how someone sees it. You know, in those days you were kind of discovered. And as you say, the Telegraph would come, they would write a piece, you'd wait for the weekend to go and buy the paper and open it up, and you would be, and I remember that excitement myself. It was like different. And it was, I sort of, you know, I mean, I suppose in a way, you know, you design for women, you also design for men now, and jewelry can empower people. And I don't mean that in a small way. I mean that you put a piece of jewelry on, it makes you feel great. So when you design the pieces, do you kind of imagine, because I've never not been out wearing a piece of your jewelry, and this is the God's honest truth, without somebody saying that's a beautiful piece. And today people will know that that's your jewelry. But in those days, people didn't necessarily. And that was kind of quite nice for a consumer to be able to say, oh, yes, it's, you know, Stephen Webster, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Well, do I miss it? Of course. I think we all reminisce about those times, because every stage feels exciting. And, you know, sometimes you can get bogged down in things that you just wish I was back in my little store in, you know, Manchester Square. But then, you know, you've got to make progress, and with it comes other sort of excitements, I suppose. But I think, you know, going back to that time and the idea that I was selling to the end consumer, to the woman who was going to wear it, changed everything, because women would come in and they know exactly what they want. You know, and with my crystal haze, what I was able to do with that material, because rather than have the center of the piece of jewelry be all intrinsic value, it really wasn't, you know, it was technique. So what you were buying, what you just said, the piece of mother of pearl with a faceted quartz cap, there's no part of that that's got super high value. So it's about the design, and it's judged differently. And I think, so yes, it's gold, and yes, it had some small diamonds with it to, you know, put it into the fine jewelry category of the time.
And it's big and it's weighty. Yeah. And it makes you feel like, you know, you're the Pope.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing that we'd come with, say, I mean, it happened all the time. You know, guys would come to me and go, God, you know, I bought my wife, she's got, you know, a $50,000 diamond ring or sapphire or whatever. And, you know, yours is all she wears and all she gets comments on. And of course, it was way, way cheaper piece. And I suppose people should have been grateful. but it was something to have the middle of a piece of fine jewelry not be, you know, full of all the value, really. It was,
And so, like, how do you gauge success in business? Is it money, turnover, size, or is it your audience, or is it more the pleasure that you get out of it and how you sort of see your moment now? Because you're very much a kind of moment person rather than a planner, planning forward.
Yeah, I mean, I still get a buzz out of, you know, that moment, if you like, you know, something where, you know, either something you've made has been like really received well, or people are talking about it, or, you know, for example, I was at a lunch in a garden at the weekend, you know, one of those ones we all have at the moment. They're a bit strange, but nonetheless, at least we're mingling in some way. And the person whose event it was, whose lunch it was, had commissioned for me a Viking helmet, and he just wanted it Yeah, well, he's Swedish and he's made a lot of money and he's like a Viking. And he wanted it just as a, like, I think for, you know, his next fancy dress was going to be Viking helmet. And so he starts to give me some sort of ideas of how grand he wanted this thing. And I'm in the end, I'm saying, look, you know, I can do this because I can make anything as long as it's made of metal. But we're talking now quite a thing. And so a friend of his said, what about if you make it dual purpose? Can you make it a table lamp and a Viking helmet? I said, no, that's a terrible idea. But I did know that he loved caviar. So I made a replica of his head in stone. And the Viking helmet is gold and silver. It's an extraordinary thing. And it's also sits in the middle of the table. Don't forget, he is a Viking. He's Swedish. And you lift it up by the horns and under it is half a kilo of caviar.
Oh, now, brilliant.
For the first time on Saturday, because this was supposed to be his big summer party, he couldn't have that, had to have a lunch. But this thing's sitting in the middle of the table.
And how did that feel?
It was glinting in the sun. Well, it was brilliant because everybody was talking about it. It was like, what the hell? And then they realized this thing is meticulously made. You know, it could be in the British Museum. And of course, I love that moment. That's just a moment. Oh my God, it was like nearly a year. It was like, you know, 10 months of work. It was all handmade.
When you look at something like that, do you ever look at it and think, I could have done more? Or are you happy with the end result because he's happy?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the end, I think at the stage I'm at, sort of 45 years down the line, I know if I've put everything into it that I should have.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, that can sometimes mean that someone looks at something and it's not quite what they thought, but that's quite rare. I mean, generally, people are a bit like, wow, that's incredible. And as you said at the beginning, as a craftsperson, I think that means to me that it's ticked all the boxes. You know, it's obviously a bit of a spectacle. I know it's been well made. And that's kind of my job.
But you're, like me, when I meet a client, I really know how to get inside a client's head and try and extract information that they might not be able to. You know, it's one of the things I love the most about my job is that moment when you connect. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And I think as you've said, people are amazed that you can do that. I think they think it's like, you know, magic or something, but they're, in your field, as you're an expert, it's very, very easy to extract enough information to be able to start something. I mean, one of the things that's the most fun, honestly, is men's wedding rings, because men have no frigging clue. And once you start saying, you know, I'll you know, after we've sort of chatted for a bit, you know, and they're like, how can you have enough to go on? I'm not going to give anything away, you know, and then you kind of come back with something. They're like, wow, okay. Because they don't want the crown jewels, you know, they want something quite simple, but they want something that they can tell their mate. This is like this because, you know, it's kind of connected to me. And I think there's very, very few people who don't like that in jewelry or in their home, you know, to be able to say it feels connected to me.
And what do you think drives you? Is it like the passion of what you do, or is it sometimes fear or emotion, or like, can you kind of pinpoint what that feeling is that when you come up with an idea, you think of something and then it, you kind of get really excited to be able to develop it. Is it, what's the feeling?
Yeah. I mean, I probably, like, I think most creative people I know, you know, you go through moments where you've got that blank page, you know, you've got writer's block, and that can be, you know, it's not that you go down a black hole, but you can feel a bit anxious, you know, and then whatever happens is, you know, something starts to spark, and once I'm on that, then I'm, you know, I'm enthused and I'm excited about it. And, you know, this start of lockdown here, because we're at the sort of end of lockdown, I was feeling a bit that way. You know, I was kind of isolated on my own. I was not knowing what was next. I'm sure nearly everybody was.
Yeah.
And it took me a moment to sort of get myself into, you know, the the thought process of what I've got to do now from here. And once I got going, and then I was joined by my daughter who works with me, and she's like this incredibly focused bundle of energy. And the two of us realized how amazing it was to have that time to just work next to each other in the kitchen. You know, so
I mean, so let's talk about Amy, because Amy's amazing. So she's now working with you, and it's so lovely. And honestly, the times that we've spoken about it, you maybe you don't realize it, but you kind of light up. It must be such a nice thing, though, because so many parents, I'm one of them, would have loved to have had, you know, Natasha come into my business. She could have done it with her eyes shut, but she was not going to have it. So for you to have Amy, and actually just to see in the way, you know, as an artist myself, watching the way she has done the things she's done, even her Instagram posts, because she's so much younger than us, the way she's sort of taken the brand and merged with you, it just seems so seamless. I don't know if it is behind the scenes, but...
it really is. I mean, I think people, my team, you know, when you bring on, like, you know,
a family
your daughter,
member. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to kind of tread carefully, but I think they instantly, she's a very likable person. So that was that, and was, you know, there to learn, not kind of be, you know, whatever she felt she was there to kind of learn what we do. But from the moment she started, because she didn't sort of run into the job, you know, she was living in Germany. She was doing something completely different and wanted to do a trial period. So she came for a trial period and then said after like a week, Dad, I've got to do this. This is just amazing. I always, of course, she's grown up with me as a jewelry dad, but once she sort of starts to get under the skin of it, felt that she could serve a purpose, and now 2 years down the line, she's really, really on board. She's invested in it, you know, totally, her whole everything, and it's just amazing because we do work together really well. We're very similar, so it could be that you didn't, you know, it might go, oh my God, this,
yeah.
But I think she likes my enthusiasm. I love hers, and my team feel that we've got, you know, a next generation Webster on board, which is really great for them because, you know, most of them are more in their 30s, up to 30, and she's similar. She's 28. So now they've got someone who speaks their language.
And have you seen her do anything that you have sort of thought, like, well, either have you seen her do something where you've gone, ooh, that's sort of not what I would have done? Or have you seen her do something where you've kind of gone, wow, like, why didn't I think of that? That's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have on the content. I'm always a bit blown away by it because we never had anything like it. You know, it was part of the reason why I wanted her to come on board was because I'm seeing what she's doing for other brands, mainly fashion brands. And I just thought, oh, you know, I knew we needed that. So that stuff has been just fabulous. But then now seeing her with a client, I'm totally amazed. I didn't know she had that in her. You know what I mean? She's just got a really great way of communicating. And you see it rub off on people. They're totally compelled and engaged by it. So it's not like she's doing a hard sell or something, you know, and it's because she loves it. She talks about
a good thing because I always say, like, it's hard when you are actually selling something, but actually, and some people don't realize this, that the passion for the you know, the chatter, you know, having the banter, getting to the point of actually someone commissioning something can almost be as much satisfaction as being paid for it. I know that sounds ridiculous, but for me, that, you know, it's that relationship. Do you find that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I suppose with you, you're going to have a client that you've done a lot of work for. But, you know, let's say you do someone's main home or something, and maybe you do their, you know, a resort home or whatever it is. So you develop a relationship. I think with something like jewelry, it's amazing how close your relationship can become with your long-term clients, because there sort of always seems to be an occasion when you're back in front of them, you know? And I think what happens is there's trust. So that's the big one. But then there's also, they know that you're going to come up with something that's going to work. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep coming back to you, you know, and I really love that. And then, you know, they often, of course, become much more than a client, become your friends. But I think the fact that you can be sort of always there when they need their piece of jewelry is kind of a nice thing. And you see excitement from them. So like you said, it's not like you're going to have to go and do a hard sell. I think that's probably been done once people feel that you're what you are, what you say you are. They obviously look at the work and like it or don't work it, and then they want to know about it. And I think that's the main thing, isn't it? The banter is being able to talk with authority about what it is that you're doing, how you're working it, why you're doing something.
And so, I mean, do you think that the industry? Well, two sort of questions, like. I was going to say, do you think the industry's changed? But do you think it's going to change even more now with what we've just all sort of experienced and are still going through with COVID in terms of how you, not how you create jewellery, but how you sell it or how you want to sell it? Would you go back to being small and niche, still have the amazing collections, but have a different kind of environment to sell in? Or, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think... without a doubt, the retail side of my business. So, you know, whether it's my store or Bergdorf Goodman or Neiman Marcus, both of whom were my biggest clients for many years, have both now filed for bankruptcy. I think without a doubt, that side of things was already challenged. You know, it was a challenge for store owners to know how to get someone just to walk into this store, you know, to sort of say, well, you know, rather than buying online, come to us. So everything had to be experiential. And I think we felt that we had something that gave people a reason to come into a store if we were doing an event, because I've not really done an event where no one shows up. You know, you kind of go, right, well, if it's in New York or it's LA or Seoul or somewhere, you know, wherever,
people
kind of can attract a crowd, because you've got to be a bit of an entertainer and I think quite comfortable doing that. So I think that, you know, the sort of side to retail, I think now has been impacted 10 times quicker than it was going to be. But I think that, you know, we all have to sort of work out how we connect with our clients. And a lot of what we've done in recent years has been much more than just someone walking into a shop and buying something. That feels to me like that was almost a lifetime ago. And people haven't stopped buying things. They just buy them in different ways. And I think even though, you know, people talk about, well, you know, buying online, it's fine. It's very, very convenient. But I think in luxury, there's still people still want to feel a bit spoiled, a bit like, you know, the way that the conglomerates, the LVs and the Richemonts, I mean, my God, the amount they spend on getting someone to come into their shop as opposed to just being online. And I think, you know, they keep everybody on their toes. And you've got to kind of work out your way that you're going to work around that, you know.
I mean, for me, I love shopping. I'm a consumer. But I sort of feel like now I don't want to go to a Selfridges. I don't want to go to a Harrods. I can buy things online. But if I want to buy something special, and there's nothing better than going and touching and feeling and trying on, and, you know, in case of jewellery, I sort of wish there were more small little ateliers, small shops, like, you know, we would always find in Italy, and you'd find that one little shop that had the best edit. Because for me, shopping is about going in and there's an edit there that just works for you. And I think, and I'm not a retailer, that people are going to go back to wanting more of that because of what we've just been through. And then you look at the news yesterday and thousands of people are rushing out to go and buy something.
I was surprised at that myself, but I completely agree. I think the other side to the business, which we is now probably the strongest category, is a bespoke, you know, anything we do bespoke. And it's not that bespoke needs to have 10 noughts on the end. You know, I think I try to make it, you know, as democratic as it can be. You know, if someone says to me, look, you know, we want a wedding ring, but we don't want it off the shelf, that's not going to be the biggest sale I'm going to make. I'll still sit there, we'll make something for them. And that's bespoke. And that, I think that sort of consultation, people are more and more, okay, from the very wealthy, that's kind of what they want. They don't want things that just come off the shelf.
Yeah.
But I think for a younger consumer as well, we're doing everything we can to encourage people not to think that this is now going to be something that's prohibitively expensive. It's just a better experience. And of course, once someone's done it once, there's no way they're going to go back and just, you know, shop in the same way. You know, they you know, I'm talking about jewelry terms. So they're going to want that again because it was great, you know. And so I think it's down to, you know, each individual company, how they deal with it. But for us, you know, we're still small. I've had 15 stores before. I've got like four now.
Stressful was that, for God's sake?
Yeah, it was really stressful. I mean,
isn't it funny? It's like one of those things where you just want to grow and you want it, and then suddenly you wake up one morning and you think, why have I done this? It's like stress involved, and you sort of think, what has it given me? And sometimes I think that with my business so big, and I just think, God, you know, yeah, you know, like, is it really that necessary? And then you sort of go back and you're back in your day and it all passes. But
yeah, stores for independents in luxury now are a massive challenge because the streets where you feel you need to be are owned, you know, by the big groups, and the rents are crazy. I mean, my last store I had on Rodeo Drive, I was so chuffed when I opened that door because, you know, now on the corner overlooking the hotel where Pretty Woman was filmed, and I'm looking down really, and you're like, oh my God. And then of course the rent was so astronomical, and plus the armed guard. And I, in the end, I'm working as hard as I can work to pay the rent.
Yeah.
And we only just made it.
And it's demoralizing, isn't it? It's just demoralizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you think you're good at juggling like work and family?
Yeah, well, I've got most of my family around me. I've only got Nika that's not. And we're hoping that with her Chinese and Russian and English, she may be useful to us at some point. Yeah, but and then my brother, you know, I've got my brother as well.
No, so, I know. I was going to say, like, he's very much a part of the company. Actually, I hadn't really thought about it. It really is a family affair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And but I'm very, very lucky that, you know, I think we don't have a glass ceiling. You know, my managing director, she's, you know, I really treat her very much like the boss. And, you know, she started working for me 17 years ago as a very junior marketing person. And, you know, I think we're, you know, in all of the managerial positions, head of marketing, head of merchandising, MD, head designer, they're all women. None of them are in the family. That's a really good message that I always wanted to give to people who join the company. Otherwise, you know, if you join a company that's all family, you think, well, I'm only going to get so far here.
But is it hard to sort of keep business out of home? Like when you finish work, I know the answer. Yeah.
If this was on camera, Kelly, I tell you, because I'm sitting in my kitchen and it's just like my desk at work. It's cut. I've been drawing all day. I've got some gemstones out. I mean, it's really funny because we're in a time now where, you know, it's not quite the same, but I mean, it's impossible to separate it if you all work together, but you do your best. And I mean, I feel that, you know, we somehow manage both. I think we do. I mean,
and tell me, whose point of view is the most important to you in your life?
In my life?
Yeah.
Or in my working life? I mean, obviously Ashley's got a huge point of view. but then again, you know, and I think she can probably, sometimes it drives her crazy, but she respects as well that, you know, she's not the only point of view, and you know, some of the other people in the business have got a very good point of view. So I'd say it's not just one person. It's a bit of a collective. Yeah.
And do you have a mantra that you've always stood by?
Yeah, we're rebels with a cause.
Yeah, of course.
Which is definitely one we've kept for a long time, yeah.
Yeah. And when you're overwhelmed, what do you do?
I'll probably freak out, same as everyone else.
Panic, eat?
You know what? No, not necessarily. I think I'm really, I realise, especially at this moment as well, that I'm a much better team player than being like, you know, solo.
Yeah.
I think since I very, very first started my own business, you know, I very quickly sort of built a small team, and I think you've probably done the same. And I work better in it as a member of the team,
yeah.
Especially nowadays, because I'm quite happy. I know I'm always going to have an opinion, of course I am, but I quite like watching other people be really good at what they do. So if I'm feeling freaked out, I'll make sure I share it. Yeah, I'm not going down on my own with this one.
And so, like, your collections, like, you've got, you know, the one that I love is called Tattoo.
Right.
Which I've got loads of pieces from, which I adore. Like, have you come up with something? You don't have to say what it is, but in this lockdown, do you think you've come up with another collection, another story that's come out of this time,
yeah,
this pandemic?
Yeah, I have.
Is it called Virus?
No, it hasn't. To be honest, I can't share a name with you yet because I haven't got that far. I'm still pondering. But I think it's something that feels to me that, you know, there's a narrative that maybe I've certainly experienced by being in lockdown, because, you know, I've really noticed a lot more nature.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I've been grounded for 4 months and I've watched things grow and I've really enjoyed it. In fact, for lunch today, we had rocket and spinach that I grew from seeds myself. I've never, ever done anything like that before. And I'm really taking it seriously. If some slug comes along and eats anything, I'm like, I'm really angry, you know. So I suppose it's got a, I wanted something that felt maybe, I mean, look, that word tattoo is a broad church, but the pieces that you like, they're actually quite organic.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're all kind of growing, aren't they?
And the, you know, when I told you the story of Elizabeth Taylor, I think about that was 1980, let's say two or three. And I already had this sort of motif, which was a bit like a vine, a thorny vine that was around this cocktail ring. And out of that, I started sort of extracting it to become the main theme for a collection, which is what you're talking about. So I like storytelling for sure, but sometimes if there's, you know, it's funny, you go out in the countryside and it always feels like there's something out to get you.
Yeah.
It's like, it even wants to sting you or bite you or stick a thorn in you. And you're like, I quite like that, you know, and trying to capture that in a piece of jewellery works
for us. People might not know who listen to this. Like, you've also gone into the interiors market. So you've, tell us about that with your sort of cocktails and glass and your beautiful knives, your chopping knives, which are just stunning.
Thank you. I'm not entering too far into your world. I think it's tools.
All right, you're welcome.
It's mainly tools, which obviously you know about. But I think I was commissioned to make a ski and do, which is a little ceremonial dagger that Scottish men wear down their sock when they've got their kilt on, and they're quite ornate things. And the guy who you and I both know, he's a bit rock and roll, and he said, "Look, I want to." He just bought a castle in Fife. He said, "I need all the regalia, and I need a ski and do. I want you to make me the most rock and roll ski and do ever." So I sort of applied myself to it, and it, you know, it had sort of a miniature sheep's ram's skull on the top in black gold and black diamonds and stingray skin, and it had a blade, because you have to have a blade. It's a knife. And I'd never made a knife before, but I thought, you know, that's not going to stop me. So we made this, and it was such a beautiful thing to have. It felt like a piece of jewelry anyway, but you know, with a purpose. It was a tool.
Yeah.
And that's when I went into the carving knives. And so they're very much in the spirit of very figurative, but of course they're functional. And I suppose that's the difference between sort of straight jewelry and what I, the kind of jewelry I do for the home, because that led into the barware and the barware, it's a bit like the cocktail ring, isn't it? You know, I feel a direct connection and I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, making my cocktails up that sound like my jewelry, using my tools, has been part of what we've been doing here to sort of entertain people in a way.
It's amazing because everything you do like has a story attached to it, but it is an experience, isn't it? It's an emotion. Like everything that you make has got an emotion attached to it. Whereas you can, you know, go into, and I won't name names, but Tiffany's, and you know, where you see beautiful diamonds, of course, a girl loves diamonds, but they're just pieces of jewelry. But your stuff, it, you know, I know when I put on something of yours, it, and I'll choose which one because each one will have a different feeling to me and it will make me feel different. And I, of course, you don't know how I'm going to feel when I wear it, but I'm presuming when you design stuff, it's got emotion, it's got, you kind of think that's what. I'm not really saying. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like
no, you're right. I think when I was first sort of doing the rounds, if you like, when Stephen Webster was taking off, and it took off really in America before here, you know, I found that people were totally, you know, they loved listening to what inspires you, you know, why you choose this gemstone, and then you find what you're doing is you don't even realize it, but you're starting to become a narrator, you know, you're a storyteller. And you know, you throw in a bit of wit if you can, and you got it, you know, I mean, and the next thing is, you know, the manager of Neiman Marcus in Chicago is going, oh my god, you know, when can you come back? Because you realize that not everybody is doing that. And I think if you're comfortable with it, and I know I talk too much probably, but it's just what I am. And then people really see this is the link to the product. Like you've said, you want it to feel like it's got personality because I don't do it, you know, we don't design it for margin. That's for sure. It's for something else. And
it's shows.
All about that. Yeah.
And if you could choose one piece of jewelry that you've ever designed, do you have a favorite? Is it the ring you always wear?
I do like that one, but do you know what? I shattered it.
I've
worn it for so long. I was at one of the last things that we went to before this, and I'm clapping, and I'm like, I've suddenly got a ring of about four pieces. I mean, I've worn that for 20 years and I realized I'd basically worn it out. But no, I like my Japanese kabuki mask, which is that ring. But I think probably, you know, you've got to think about what it took me to make a crystal haze was totally just, I was just stubborn and I wanted to stick at it because I felt I was onto something, but it didn't come easily. And I mean, Assie, she was with me at the time. We'd only just really started to be together. And I think she was a bit amazed how I could just keep going back to this same thing and not getting success out of it. And then when I did, changed my whole life. And so that classic crystal haze, which you have one of, I've got to, in the end, look at that and say, well, perhaps as simple as the lines are in it, it was the thing that changed everything for me, and maybe that's the secret, you know, that it doesn't look like it's overcomplicated. It looks like it's quite simple, but it does the trick.
And you've just relaunched Crystal Haze in a different form, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was through Amy starting that she was sort of looking at it, and I just read a piece that she wrote today for Vogue about why we relaunched it. And you know, she was looking through the archive, and I think she sort of said, why don't we do this anymore? And we were like, well, you know, I've been looking at it for 25 years. And she's like, but Dad, you know, this can be really modern. It's just that a generation, my generation meaning hers, they don't know what this is, got no idea. And
I think the old one looks modern.
Yeah, well, it didn't take a lot, to be honest, Kelly. We stripped it right down. We just gave it something that felt like it was of the moment, which is what it felt like 25 years ago. And it seems to have worked, because we definitely got a lot of enthusiasm for it. And we've been making, now that we're open again, you know, we started to sell online as well. So yeah, who knows? I mean, it was nice to have something to celebrate 25 years of.
I think
a lot of people in this time have had lots of things that, you know, they've not been able to do, and like getting married and stuff like that. But you know, the big launch was going to be in Bergdorf Goodman a month ago, because they were the store that really took it on board the first time round, and they were so excited to get it back. But of course, that didn't happen. So we launched.
Maybe you've just got to look that, you know, something else will happen. And when you launch it in that place, you'll go, do you know what? It couldn't have been any better. Because, you know, sometimes out of circumstances like this, a new thought process, something just like inevitably just happens, you know, in that kind of cosmic way. So,
I'm with you completely. I'm with you. You know, I'm not down about it or anything. It's only a collection, but it was that sort of, I think, because they, as much as anyone else, I was saying earlier, you know, people are looking for, you know, what reason do we have to bring someone back into the store? So for them, that was good, you know, doing the build up. But you're right, you know, whenever we do it, we do it. Yeah.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you, like your men's jewellery, which, you know, I absolutely adore. I love girly jewellery, but I love sort of chains. And I bought some stuff that you did with Blondie. Is it Blondie? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And your new collection that you bought out, I actually could have worn every single piece. But is it more difficult to design for men, because not as many men wear jewellery?
Well, I mean, you know, when I historically, it was almost pointless. I mean, almost, you know, because you had some rock stars, and that was cool, because I sold to nearly all those, that generation, you know, from Elton to Ozzy Osbourne, Steven Tyler and all that lot, because they wore jewellery.
Yeah.
And then you very quickly got to a regular guy who didn't wear jewellery, or you had the R&B, the hip hop side, and that was a different, that was not my aesthetic, you know. So I think, even though I would always do a men's collection, it was a very slow burn. Now, and I think the collection you're talking about, and certainly the one I did with Blondie, it's unisex. You know, it's gender neutral. I hate to use that term. I'd rather say unisex, but it's really not geared. It's not hugely masculine. It's not hugely feminine. And I think I really like that. I like having this thing that doesn't have to fall into either camp. It's just for jewellery, you know.
Yeah. No, I think it's brilliant. So, last question. What's next for the Empire?
For the Empire. I've got to do a bit of Empire rebuilding, I think. This week was the week that my salon could open again. So that's nice. Just kind of welcome people back and make sure.
You're doing haircuts too.
We've been talking about doing things like getting a manicurist in. Oh my God, I don't know, whatever. But I think.
What a great idea.
We are going to. I'm not joking, Kelly. I'll keep you in the loop, because you just want to treat people really. And I think. You know, it's probably
finishing
in the spirit.
Touch, yeah, perfect. Yeah, I love that.
Well, that's
love
it, because everyone talks about their COVID manicure and stuff, don't they? So if you give them one at the same time as getting a piece of jewelry, but I think on the other side, you know, we've still got a lot that's a bit murky to work out, because, you know, America and Russia are my two biggest single markets, and neither of which are in any way, shape or form opened up properly yet. So I've got all that to look forward to. But I feel that jewellery's kind of robust. You know, it's been around longer than fashion. So I'm sure we'll find a place somewhere.
You'll find a place. And you've got such a great story to go with every single piece you design. You really do. You're iconic. You're brilliant. As I say, every piece I have, I can remember when I bought it, and I love every piece. And I hope everyone enjoys listening to this, because you're brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate you including me. Thank you very much.
Not at all. You're the first male of the new series, actually.
Oh, really?
Wow. Women, yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that's nice.
Well, enjoy the beautiful view that you've got there.
I'm just about to head up to London, but yes, we've been thoroughly spoiled. Yeah, I have to say, because of the weather, it's been crazy, hasn't it?
You know, it's been brilliant.
Yeah, the blessing in disguise. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Lots of love.
Cheers, and
take
to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.